This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up more than 70 years after World War II ended in the Pacific and the cleanup of abandoned weapons and explosives is still going on. What impact can an unparalleled week of success on the world stage have on sports development in the Pacific? And helping science, we meet the fantastic grandmothers from New Caledonia. First, though, the former commander of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force, Jerry Singerok, says the burial of two Russian-built attack helicopters at a rubbish dump in northern Australia is a fitting end for machines that were once bound for Bougainville during the island's civil war. The helicopter gunships were an integral part of the so-called Sandline affair in the 1990s, the secret $50 million deal the then PNG government signed with private military company Sandline International to supply weapons and troops in an effort to quash Bougainvillean secessionists. The Australian government took possession of the choppers in 1997, and now the ABC has discovered they were eventually buried in the hazardous waste section of a rubbish dump in Darwin. The Sandline plan never eventuated. There was outrage when it became public. Commander Singerok took the mercenaries hostage and announced the contract had been cancelled. And if the helicopters had made it to Bougainville, he says, they would have been used to commit mass murder.
Well, I'm happy that they've been finally buried because they're the instruments to bring in misery and genocide by Sandline International and the Papua New Guinea government.
So a fitting end, do you think, to those helicopters?
Absolutely fitting.
What do you think could have happened if they had have made their way to Bougainville?
There'll be a bloody war. It will be like a blood diamond in Angola. Mercenaries are ruthless. It's a machine that has no mercy, and they could have caused mayhem.
And so what do you think about the actions of the Australian government to detain those helicopter gunships and other weapons and ammunition as well back in 1997?
Yes, it was a collaboration between myself and late General John Baker, who was the Chief of Australian Defence Force, when I called him and I told him to intercept that Antonov that was bringing in the helicopters and arsenals for Bougainville. And the Australian military did intercept the aircraft, and in collaboration, they detained it. And it was the best act ever to have taken place to prevent the aircraft from landing, delivering the arsenal in Port Moresby.
And I guess it's timely in a way, this news coming out of the burial of these helicopters just ahead of the referendum in Bougainville. As you mentioned before, it could be seen by some as a kind of a closure of a dark period of history.
Yes, that's correct. It is a closure of a dark history of the way, manner in which Papua New Guinea government handled a series of Papua New Guinea governments that handled the crisis in Bougainville from 1989 to 1997. And of course, the involvement of Rio Tinto and the Australian government. It was a touch and go for the Australian government. They were not really sure what to do. They could not condemn. They didn't know what to say until I kicked out Sandline in 97.
Sir Julius Chan, Prime Minister at the time, wrote a book where one of the things he said was that he regretted nothing and wouldn't have changed a thing. Did you see that? And what did you think about that?
Well, he's a totally irresponsible leader. I still maintain that he was singly responsible for bringing in Sandline because he was the chairman of the National Executive Council. And I think he acted criminally as far as I'm concerned.
And I'm guessing you would have similar sentiments of your own actions to his in that you don't regret what you did back then?
No, I did the unorthodox thing, which is to use my powers as a commander to prevent a massive genocide. And I still, to this day, say that I did the right thing because I was acquitted in 2007 of all criminal charges.
Former commander of the PNG Defence Force, Jerry Singerok, speaking there to Liam Fox. Now, nearly eight decades after World War II came to an end in the Pacific, unexploded bombs and abandoned explosives still pose a danger to communities in Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu and Solomon Islands. So this week, Australian defence personnel have been on the ground in the Solomons as part of the latest stage in a clean-up mission which has been running for years. But in the era of Canberra's step up, it's one way for the Australian government to demonstrate that its commitment to its Pacific neighbours is genuine. Georgina Kakea reports.
The Battle of Guadalcanal may be history, but its remnants are not.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Thousands of these are in the form of unexploded bombs. Solomon Islands was a strategic point for world powers during the Second World War. Its geostrategic location made it a valuable asset with access to international sea lanes. Now, with Solomon Islands' newfound relation with China, Australia is stepping up its game to safeguard the so-called Pacific interest.
We'll be focusing on making it safe as locations close to schools, housing, and anywhere that's affecting people's day-to-day life.
Australian boots were on the ground this week with 700 military and navy personnel in country as HMAS Adelaide arrived for Operation Render Safe.
No smoking, no naked lights, no mobile phones within 8 metres of the point. Helo refueling in progress.
Commander Taylor Laxwood Sanderson is in charge of the operation and had been coordinating work from the HMAS Adelaide.
Any time that there are requests from the government of the Solomon Islands to support, Australia normally answers that, and we can send teams. We've sent mentoring training teams to Hells Point, where their school is, quite recently. This year alone, we've been there 3 times to provide support in training, making sure that the skills of the team are still progressing well and that we're passing on new knowledge and new processes to make sure that they continue to grow and improve their processes.
The Western Province is home to around 90,000 people, making it the third most populated province in the Solomons. It's home to some of the most beautiful islands, yet it saw some of the most fiercest fighting in the Second World War. Captain Jonathan Lay is commanding officer on board the HMAS Adelaide.
Our major role on the Western Borders is to assist the police force in improvements to the infrastructure for the police stations in both those locations, helping with some water pump, things like that. If there is anything that we can help with, once we are on the ground with the police force, then obviously we'll have a look at how feasible that is. It should be, if it's low-level stuff, and we've got the time to do it. Absolutely, we'll help up. We're here to assist with the rendering of ammunitions and make it a safer place to be.
Operation Render Safe takes place every 2 years and alternates between Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. This year, a team from New Zealand's military are also part of the operation. Commander Taylor Laxford Sanderson, officer in charge of Operation Render Safe.
There is a record of what operations occurred during World War II, and we then assess from where those operations are where most of the explosives will be. So yes, there is a list that is being compiled and created, and that's the same as we work through this operation. So we will make safe in priority order the things that are affecting people's life and their safety.
Operation Render Safe ends in a week's time.
Georgina Kakea reporting from Solomon Islands. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. Next to Marshall Islands, where the Nuclear Commission there are exploring the possibility of legal action against the United States over a massive nuclear waste leak. The chair of the commission is Ria Moss-Christian, and she says it's the organisation's belief that more than 99% of the radioactive waste left over after US nuclear weapons testing during the 1940s and 50s has seeped into the Eniwetok Atoll Lagoon from what is known as the Runit Dome.
The contamination that exists outside the dome has always been outside the dome since the testing occurred. And what we learned from the Department of Energy studies was that less than 1% of the contamination on Eniwetok was contained inside the dome. So in the case of Eniwetok and the leadership and stakeholders that we met with, nuclear justice for them is for that contamination to be removed from their island.
What was the reaction from both you and the commission and the people in the Marshall Islands when they heard those numbers?
Well, we were all a bit surprised because when the dome was constructed, the idea was that the dome would cover and contain the radioactive waste. So to find out that less than 1% of the contamination is in the dome and most of it is outside the dome, then it made us wonder what was the purpose of constructing this facility.
And what's the reaction from the US been?
Well, the US continues to monitor the dome and monitor the groundwater, and they continue to maintain that levels are safe enough not to cause any grave harm to nearby residents, but residents are also advised to stay away or to stay off the island where the dome is currently located.
That seems quite contradictory, though, doesn't it? To say on the one hand, no, everything's fine, but on the other hand, leave.
It does, and it's just because Eniwetok Atoll is comprised of several islands, so the residents live on an island that's on the other side of the atoll from Runet Island, where the dome is located. But yes, of course, they're still in proximity of the dome, and so this is the discomfort that the residents feel and the people of Eniwetok and throughout the Marshall Islands is what does this exposure, chronic exposure to this radioactive waste, mean for our health and the future health, the health of our children and next generations and the environment.
What are the current impacts that are being felt by the people and the environment?
Well, throughout the Marshall Islands, we have a very high cancer rate, and these are cancer rates at a level that the government is ill-equipped to handle. All of our cancer patients are referred overseas for treatment. Mm-hmm. Environmentally, there are studies from DOE tell us that primarily the giant clams and clam species in Eniwetok are the ones where most of the contamination is concentrated, but that the fish species are okay, but it depends on your perception, and perception is important for the residents there, and they don't feel that their marine environment is safe, and they don't feel safe being in such close proximity.
So, Rhea, how seriously are you looking into filing a lawsuit against the U.S.?
Well, we're seriously considering all options, including legal options. I mean, our feeling is how can we not consider legal options that might still be available? We are bound by previous cases, by provisions in our compact agreement with the United States, but these are not, in our view, exclusive of any other options, legal options in particular, that might be available.
That's Rhea Moss-Christian, Chair of Marshall Islands Nuclear Commission, speaking there to Talia Ulatia. An Australian mining company operating a nickel mine in Solomon Islands has been effectively forced to stop all its activities in the country. The national government has advised Axiom of its intention to cancel the company's foreign investment registration. That development comes after the government also refused to grant Axiom an export permit, preventing it from shipping ore to overseas customers. But as Liam Fox reports, Axiom are ready to go to court because they say the cancellation is unlawful.
It's been a tough year for Axiom Mining, and it just got even tougher. The Commerce Ministry has issued a notice of cancellation of the company's foreign investment certificate of registration.
It is frightening, it is disturbing.
Axiom CEO Ryan Mount believes the move is unlawful.
There was a number of grounds that they claim. None of them are based on any lawful premise. But one of them, the one that we could understand, was that they claim we did not have a business licence in the province. However, there is absolutely no obligation for Axiom to have a business licence.
The lack of a business licence from the provincial government in Isabel, where Axiom's mining operations are located, is also the reason the Ministry of Mines has refused to grant the company an export permit. Axiom currently has 70,000 tonnes of ore stockpiled, waiting to be sent to customers overseas, but without a permit, it's stuck in the Solomons. Mr. Mount says the company has applied to the Isabel provincial government for a licence, but they were refused.
There is no clear reason. We've been given a number of varying reasons, but we can't quite understand it either. However, privately they have discussed concerns that they've been approached by other organisations, putting pressure on them to prevent us from providing us a business licence.
Early this year, Mr. Mount was engaged in a very public war of words with the mining minister, Bradley Tovasia, with the pair exchanging verbal barbs through the local media. At one stage, Mr. Mount called the minister corrupt. Mr. Tovasia threatened to sue him for defamation. Mr. Mount urged him to bring it on. Mr. Mount has previously said he hopes the personal enmity is not the reason for the company's problems with the government. Meanwhile, the deputy director of the Ministry of Commerce's Foreign Investment Division, Siali Turunga, says the notice of cancellation means Axiom has to stop work.
They cannot continue with their operate their business activity.
She says Axiom did not comply with the conditions of its foreign investment approval, chiefly the failure to get a provincial business licence. Asked if it's linked to the refusal to grant an export permit, given the justifications are the same, she says the Foreign Investment Division's registrar sits on the Mines and Minerals Board, and through the board, became aware of Axiom's lack of a provincial business licence. Ms. Turunga says that's not the only reason the notice of cancellation was issued.
After 12 months of operation, they have to give a progressive report of their business activity. But then within the 7 years of operating here in the Solomons, they have not provided us with any report.
The Premier of Isabel Province, Leslie Kokolo, was unavailable for comment. The former Premier, James Harbu, says businesses do require a licence to operate in the province.
According to provincial law, yes. Then also when you want to export, the Comptroller of Customs has to check whether they have a business licence.
He confirmed Axiom applied for a licence but couldn't say why it was refused.
There were some issues within the process. The Ministry of Mines, there were stories coming out there that were not clear.
Axiom's Ryan Mount says the company will object to the cancellation and go to court to fight it if necessary, as it has done regarding the export permit refusal.
We don't want to get involved in scuttlebutt and dealing under the table or anything the like. The fact is we operate to the law and we're going to continue to do so, and we think that is the best way to serve our interests moving forward and especially the interests of all of our stakeholders in the Solomon Islands.
Ryan Mount, Chief Executive of Axiom Mining, and the reporter there, Liam Fox. You're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. Now, it's hard to recall a more momentous week in the world of Pacific sport. Papua New Guinea secured their place at the World T20 cricket finals. Tonga beat Great Britain in a rugby league test match. And Solomon Islands under-17s played their country's first ever games at a FIFA World Cup. So, while Pacific teams are making international headlines, can sports leaders turn all that attention to the region's advantage?
This is wonderful from the side in red. Papawati goes down that left-hand side. He's kept it alive. A kick and a chase by Jennings into that in-goal area. What a try that is. Finished by Katoa. Created somewhere in heaven.
Papua New Guinea will be appearing in the T20 World Cup for the first time in their history. In less than a year.
Unforgettable moments for Tongan Rugby League and PNG Cricket. And now that CJ Amini and his Barramundi's teammates are set to perform at the World Cup in Australia, the all-rounder is keen to seize the chance.
I think it's a good opportunity for us to showcase our skills in the biggest stage, especially in Australia, with a lot of the coaches and the Big Bash being around there. And hopefully we'll put on a good show and show the world what we're capable of doing. Then one of us does well and gets a contract.
But are there broader opportunities beckoning? PhD candidate David Lakissa, who specialises in the organisation of Pacifica Sport, believes there are, but there are likely to be obstacles too.
Achievements like this provide wonderful opportunities for national sporting organisations or global sporting organisations to tap into new markets. And obviously, like any business transaction, it's that return of investment or even that social return of investment that they always weigh out in the options. And then Pacific region don't have the greatest track record in terms of governance. So it'll always be an ongoing challenge.
From CJ Amini's perspective, the equation is a simple but familiar one. Give the Pacific nations more opportunities to play the best and they can match the best.
We all have the talent, but the big countries get that opportunity to play a very high standard year in, year out. And if our small countries like this can get that kind of support from big national bodies, then I reckon we'll all be up there with the best.
But always that question of governance is hovering in the background. David Lakissa, who studies at the University of Technology Sydney, believes Tonga's landmark rugby league win over the British should serve as a wake-up call for sure, but he says it doesn't guarantee a quick solution to the ongoing row between the TNRL and the International Rugby League over who controls the game in the Friendly Islands.
Particularly in that instance, when you're working where the majority of those players are based outside of Tonga and the governance is island-based, and so there needs to be that bridging of sorts. Living in the Pacific and being Pacific can be two very, very different realities. Managing those two worlds, I think that will be an ongoing challenge.
And on the cricket field, CJ Amini concedes there is still much to be done if PNG are to achieve the ultimate goal of test status.
We're not really ready there yet, but playing in the Test World Championship, that's something that, yes, we want to look at. And being a Test Nation team, I think slowly we can build towards that, and going to the T20 World Cup is the first step, and then want to make sure we go to the next 50-over World Cup and we'll start from there.
And those prospects would surely improve by leaps and bounds if Islander cricketers had turf wickets to play on. and PNG could take on Vanuatu, Samoa and Fiji in long-form competition. But right now, the only place you'll find a turf pitch is in Port Moresby.
If ICC could build a few more turf pitches, not only in PNG but around the Pacific, would be really good, because even though Australia and New Zealand, it would be much better just having turf cricket pitches in our own countries.
But while sporting bodies in the Pacific can certainly contemplate how to turn a wave of publicity to their advantage, David Lakisa, who has Samoan heritage, says while the focus is on the region, it allows the islands to teach the world a thing or two about value systems, traditional customs, and, he says, spirituality.
While it raises the spotlight of island-based sports management, sports diplomacy, sport for development, the more visibility and the more positive stories that come out of achievement and celebration, I think can help lift the profile and more so of the value Pacifica athletes and teams bring to global sport.
Pacifica sports specialist and PhD candidate David Lakisa there. And finally, conducting scientific research in remote parts of the Pacific can be difficult and expensive, but one way to reduce the cost is to work with local communities. And as Priyanka Srinivasan reports, age is no barrier, as one group of grandmothers from New Caledonia have demonstrated by helping scientists to track potentially deadly sea snakes.
As the sun rises, a group of seven women, so-called fantastic grandmothers, head down to New Caledonia's famous Lemon Bay with their cameras and snorkeling equipment. But these women are not just going for a leisurely swim. They are carrying out scientific research on sea snakes found in these waters off the capital Noumea.
When we see a sea snake, we take their photos so that you can identify what type they are.
Aline Gamaz is one of the women taking part.
We need to follow them and take their picture, sometimes not in the most academic way because our heads are underwater, but in any case it works very, very well.
The women are helping researchers track and document the sea snake population in this location that's popular with tourists. While they can be deadly, the sea snakes rarely hurt humans. Claire Gorin from the University of New Caledonia is one of the researchers.
The fantastic grandmothers are seven grandmothers that came to me in order to offer their help with my research in marine biology.
She says the grandmother's assistance has fast-tracked her work and helped the academics identify more than 200 deadly sea snakes in the water.
Before they started helping me, I used to see a dozen of snakes a year. With their help, we have 200 sightings a year.
But it's not just the grandmothers from New Caledonia that are helping out academics. Across the Pacific, individuals and communities are helping scientists. Divers are helping to study sharks, while local fishers are capturing information about their reefs. It's called citizen science, a way for ordinary people to contribute to scientific research.
In the Pacific, it's also often very challenging to collect data, particularly at remote locations.
Mitchell Harley is a coastal erosion expert from the University of New South Wales. 2 years ago, he helped develop CoSNAP, a tool to help people send important information about their shorelines to scientists. The project sets up metal phone docks on beaches around the world. This allows passers-by to slide in their phones and take a photo of the ocean, always at the same angle and same location.
The idea is that everybody has a smartphone, or most people have a smartphone in their pockets, and the idea is to turn that smartphone into a tool to measure how our coastlines are changing over time.
CoSNAP is currently in 10 countries, including Fiji, but the aim is to extend the tool across the Pacific. Dr. Harley says there's often a criticism of this sort of citizen science in the academic world, that it is a good educational tool but doesn't provide the robust level of data needed for research. But he disagrees. He argues that for his work, CoSNAP is invaluable, providing important information about the environment, information that would be impossible to get otherwise.
We often see photos of the effects of storms after they've occurred, but what we don't have is that crucial before images, so the pre-storm photos. And with CoSnap, because it's always at the same location and people are doing it regularly over time, we can see the before and after effects of these extreme events.
As for the fantastic grandmothers in New Caledonia, they are happy to share their love for the oceans with the scientific community and encourage others to do the same.
I would say that each person should follow their passion and what they love doing, and if we can help this sort of citizen science as well, then it's ideal.
Aileen Gamaz, one of the fantastic grandmothers in New Caledonia, ending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart. Thank you very much for listening.